gets me the most are the hijacked planes. I can't imagine what it must have been like to realize you're actually aiming for something. You're not going to land in Afghanistan or be held hostage on some tarmac. You're going to die in 3 seconds. What's frightening is that this was so ingenious and perfectly orchestrated. Who did this? Patsy and I met at 6 o'clock at the cafe on Saint-Sulpice. She'd been watching CNN and told me that, as Americans abroad, we're supposed to keep a low profile and avoid speaking English on the street. It's a standard warning the State Department issues whenever there's trouble. French police have blocked off areas of the Marais and are stopping pedestrians to ask for their papers. Flights en route to New York return to De Gaulle, and I'm not sure when they'll resume. All American airports are closed, as are the bridges and tunnels leading into Manhattan. I tried calling Amy, but all the lines were clogged. She doesn't get out of bed before noon, so I'm assuming she's okay. Stephen called me at midnight to tell me that Rakoff and Sarah are fine, as is Art Spiegelman. On the television, Giuliani is saying that as many as 10,000 people might have died. On the radio, the events being compared to D-Day, Bush called it an attack on freedom itself, while Jacques Chirac, much more eloquently, called it an attack on civilization. September 14th. Last night, we attended the memorial service held at the American Church over by the Musée d'Orsay. Unlike Wednesday's service at the American Cathedral, this was a full-fledged media event, with appearances by President Chirac, Prime Minister Jospin, and the mayor of Paris. I'd never been in a room with the president, and thought it was nice the way he paused every so often and made eye contact with the audience. The church isn't very big, and half the pews were reserved with signs reading Parliament, High Dignitaries, and Diplomatic Corps. This being the American church, I'd assumed the service would be in English, but aside from a few opening remarks, everything was said in French. Brief, 5-minute sermons were delivered by a Protestant minister, the Grand Rabbi of Paris, and a Muslim cleric with a strange gray comb-over. The choir sang, the service ended, and just as the dignitaries were filing out the door, someone in the back of the room started singing, God Bless America. The man started, and his countrymen joined in, including Jessie Norman, who placed her hand over her heart and sang as if she were just an average, devastated woman, rather than an opera star. The thing about God Bless America is that after a certain point, nobody really knows the words. There's always a weird mumbling that follows, stand beside her and guide her, and lasts until from the mountains to the prairies. Then there's the bit about the oceans white with foam, which is just a strange thing to mention in a patriotic song. What killed me, what killed many of us, was the very end. My home, sweet home. Because whatever else Paris might be, this is not our home. It's just the place where we have our jobs or apartments. How could we have forgotten that? September 24th, Amsterdam. The day before yesterday, a chemical plant exploded in Toulouse. Patsy called to tell me about it, and as we'd done a week earlier, we both turned on our TVs and continued to talk while flipping between channels. 29 people were reported dead, and hundreds were injured. Windows were smashed for miles around. A woman lay on the sidewalk crying. Men mopped their bloody faces with the sleeves of their sport coats. The first assumption was that it had been a bomb, but after an hour or so, they attributed it to human error, which was a huge relief. The thing is that we've been expecting something. Everyone's just sort of waiting for the next big event. Yesterday morning, the phone rang, and I heard Hugh say, "Oh my God, you're kidding, when?" I was sitting at my desk, imagining the worst, when he covered the receiver and said that Leslie had chipped a tooth. September 28th, Paris. Don called last night to talk. I'm thinking that before he dials, he makes a list of topics, adding little notes pertaining to this or that subject. Halfmans, send faxes, no response. Anything unexpected seems to throw him off balance, and it's painful to listen as he tries to right himself. Amsterdam, right. That reminds me of Oh, it was that movie with what's-her-name, when she and the guy get thrown into the water and so forth. It was, no, maybe that was Venice, or rather they made it in Amsterdam, because of course everything's so hard when it comes to the Italians. But Amsterdam, that reminds me of, oh, he was this great old guy who was up near, I think it was Greenland, and he got lost somehow, and, well, what with the weather and so forth, he got the thing with the disease, and he had to cut off his own feet, which is what's happening right now to Bradbury with his diabetes. They didn't remove the entire foot, but they took a part of it, and, oh, it's just been a rough couple of weeks here. October 2nd, New York. I called Amy at 4 a.m., Paris time, and finally got through to her. She told me that a few days after the World Trade Center collapsed, she went to a play rehearsal on the Upper East Side. The trains were moving faster than she'd anticipated, and she wound up arriving early with half an hour to kill. There's a Gucci boutique up on Madison Avenue, and although the brand has never appealed to her, she went inside and looked around. The saleswoman was pushy, and within 10 minutes, Amy was strapped into a pair of shoes with very high heels. They were uncomfortable, and when she removed them, she noticed that the insides were stained with blood. Wet blood. Her blood. The shoes had caused her to pop a blister, but rather than writing it off as an accident, the saleswoman told Amy that now she pretty much had to pay for them, to the tune of $500. I can't fault Amy for giving in, as I would have done the same thing. She bought the shoes she'd never liked in the first place, and was leaving the store when she was approached by what she described as two hippies. She met the new anti-globalization hippies, who were even more self-righteous than the old ones. The pair moved up the street, and as they passed her, one of them spat, "The world is falling apart, so let's all go shopping, right?" Feeling now both shallow and taken advantage of, Amy went to a deli and asked for a brown paper sack. She transferred the shoes into it, threw the box and the Gucci bag into the trash, and continued on to her rehearsal. Eventually, she got the bloodstains out with an ice cube, but she couldn't return the high heels, as she'd thrown the receipt into the trash can. The world is falling apart, and now she's stuck with this pair of shoes. October 6th, Paris. A stranger called and left a message saying that he, too, knew someone who'd attempted to talk pretty. My friend tried to say he was hungry, but instead he said, "I am a woman." Anyway, keep writing. I'd never anticipated that people would want to work the title of my book into a sentence, though I guess I should have expected as much. They did the same with Naked. "I told a friend to get naked, ha," or "I was reading Naked, but hey, not literally." Yesterday's stranger phoned from the airport and apologized for not having called me sooner. October 7th. The French meteorologists have gone on strike, meaning that no one knows what the forecast will be from one day to the next. The TV weathermen are still there, but they have no reports to deliver. Instead of predicting what might happen tomorrow, they discuss what already happened today, saying things like, "Well, as you can see, we had some rain." It's a news report designed for shut-ins. October 8th. When hauled before the new world court of folly and decadence, I will have to admit that when the war broke out, I was standing in the Paris branch of the Jill Sander boutique, talking to a woman in a calf-length Prada vest trimmed with the fur of a aborted fetal lamb. An American press had just published the collected snapshots of Dennis Hopper, and we'd been invited by Leslie to the launch party. The first bombs fell on Iraq as the guest of honor made his way to the second floor, and the news was delivered by Lauren Bacall, who wore a fist-sized jeweled hair clip, the tiny stones arranged into the message, "I love Paris." October 10th. The news gets more distressing every day. I'm lucky then to have Hugh, who's taken the calm and logical approach. Last night before going to bed, he said, "What are you so worried about? The guy's finished. He can't even come out of his cave." I thought of how strange that might have sounded a year ago. He can't even come out of his cave. Who would I have thought he was talking about? What kind of a person lives in a cave? What initially set me off was bin Laden's television appearance. It wasn't live, of course. It was just a speech recorded in, well, his cave. The language was very Baroque, and I would have laughed were he not calling for the complete annihilation of my country. It was both horrible and horribly overwritten. America is scared, he said, from the north to the south, from the east to the west. Why not just say that America is scared all over? His call for a holy war was backed up last night by a taped message from his Al-Qaeda network. A spokesman said that more planes would be hijacked. I don't necessarily believe they'll be able to do it again, but with every broadcast they inflame more of their followers. It's really disheartening to see those narrow streets choked with people, raising their fists and calling for our death. I was uncomfortable but felt better after talking to Paul. Listen, he said. Those folks running from the World Trade Center, they eat with knives and forks. They wear shoes, understand? See, we've moved on. We've progressed while they're sitting around in the dirt just toiling with that shit. Okay, they fucked us up a little. We let our guard down and they got us. That shit happens. But it won't happen again. Not Paul. They should put him on TV. This afternoon, we went to look at sofa beds at a store on the Boulevard Raspail. I was just wondering if a certain model came in a smaller size when the saleswoman interrupted me and asked if I was English. I said that I was American, and for the next 20 minutes she talked nonstop, the words gushing from her mouth like water from a fire hose. You have to stop this bombing, she said, because the people, they'll get mad, and we don't know what they're going to do next. They could corrupt our drinking water, and then what? You open a tap and you die, or maybe they blow up our nuclear power plants, and then what? It's over, all of this, the whole world is over, and yes, what they did was terrible, but you're only going to get them stirred up. They're crazy, the Israelis are crazy, and when they're done fighting, whoever wins is going to come after us. They'll poison the earth and the water, and there'll be chaos and rioting, and we'll all die. I understood her fear, but is that really the way to sell a sofa bed? October 17th, New York. There certainly are a lot of flags here. The first was the size of a placemat and waved from the taxi I took from JFK. The driver was Polish and said that the thing had made it hard for all foreigners. I call it a thing, he said, because I don't want to say the word for what it is. I won't say his name neither, because to me he has no name. He's just a chicken shit motherfucker. He said that at least Hitler had been a gentleman about things. He'd said he would start a war, and he did. But the chicken shit, he didn't give any warning at all, the motherfucker. I saw flags glued to bumpers and waving from car antennas. And then, when we arrived in the city, I saw them everywhere, mainly in the windows of businesses. Many of the flags are on posters saying either, "United we stand," or, "We won't let them break our spirit." Had I known nothing about the events of September 11th, I probably would have thought it was some sort of holiday. On my own, though, I wouldn't have noticed the missing World Trade Center. I walked south a few times, but looked at the spot where it used to be only because it was no longer there. On my way downtown, I walked through Union Square, but except for a few signs and posters, the memorial shrines are gone. Mainly, it just seems a lot quieter than usual. When someone is loud or overly joyful, people stare for a moment, pursing their lips, and then they turn away. October 18th. Yesterday's cab driver told me that anthrax had been piped through the air ducts at the White House and infected 300 people. He said it with great authority, claiming to have heard it on the radio, but it turns out not to be true. The volume control is broken on my hotel television. I turned on CNN as soon as I got into the room and heard, along with everyone else on my floor, the newscaster screaming that 30 Washingtonians had been infected. She mentioned Tom Daschle's office, but said nothing about the White House. I'm finding it hard to get upset over anthrax. Yes, it's bad, but I can't help thinking it's the work of an American nut. It's not efficient enough to be a terrorist plot, unless, of course, the goal is simply to spread panic. I thought of watching the news before going to bed, but it was just too loud. I've gotten spoiled, so it put me in a very bad mood when Air France told me I would not be upgraded to business class on yesterday's flight. Stephen had arranged a transfer using my frequent flyer miles, but according to the woman at the counter, the airline was not making that today. The plane was half full, and I was on the aisle of an empty, four-seat middle section. Before takeoff, a French couple left their assigned places and took two of the ones on my row, leaving an empty space between us. Moments later, the true owner of the far aisle seat arrived, so the couple moved down, making ours the only full row on the entire plane. I was seething. Then the man in front of me reclined his seat, and I was reduced to 6 inches of lap room. I couldn't even read a magazine. The movie was Cats and Dogs, but I couldn't bend forward to get my headphones, so I just sat there, hating the French. Ronnie called last night to tell me I'd been a question on Jeopardy, the answer being he wrote the Santillan Diaries. I don't know what the category was. She told me that a week after the bombing, members of her local Chamber of Commerce approached the businesses on her street, asking them to display a picture of the flag with the caption, "We mourn our victims." Ronnie agreed, and a few days later she was approached by the same people who wanted her to display a sign reading, "Hate-Free Zone." She said she'd rather not, and they got angry at her, thus betraying the spirit of the sign they were asking her to hang in her window. "Everyone else is doing it," they said. "You've got the flag in the window, so what's your problem?" The problem, she explained, was that it was just stupid. "Like what?" she said. "Some vengeful person is going to see the sign and say, 'Whoops, I can't buy shoes here. This is a hate-free zone.'" If things truly worked that way, she'd hang up a sign reading, "Shoplifting Free Zone" or "Impulse Buying Zone." The businesses on either side of her agreed to display the new signs and now regard Ronnie's shoe store as a haven for the disgruntled. October 19th. The flags are much larger uptown. On Fifth Avenue, they're big enough to cover football fields. Walk down the street and you hear someone playing the Star Spangled Banner on a trumpet, competing with the guy across the street who's pounding out America the Beautiful on one of those Caribbean oil drums. What's missing are the tourists who would normally stop to listen. It's not exactly dead, but most of the people who are out and about seem to have business here. Shops are hurting, and when you enter a store, the sales clerks fall all over you. Buying things you don't need or want has become a patriotic duty, so I went to Barney's and got a tie. October 20th, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Where do I start with Wilkes-Barre? My hotel is located on the town square, which is bedecked with hanging electric flags, these interspersed with regular cloth versions the size of beach towels. They hang from wires, lamp posts, and a huge metal armature built to support the dozens of speakers used to broadcast a loop tape of patriotic songs and marches. I arrived to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which was followed by God Bless America, America the Beautiful, and, strangely enough, Dixie. After these came a number of marches, including a song played when the president enters the room, and something I recall hearing once on a coffee commercial. When finished, the tape returned to the Battle Hymn of the Republic and started all over again. The hotel feels like an indoctrination center. "Our mayor is crazy," everyone says. "He's completely lost his mind." Wilkes-Barre is shut tight by 6 o'clock, but still the music blares, playing for an audience of no one. October 23rd, Allentown, Pennsylvania. As part of yesterday's program, I met with students at the local college. Normally I try to get out of things like that, but I wound up having a good time, mainly, I think, because of the teacher, a bearded 48-year-old named Alec. He met me at the airport, and after the reading, we joined a few of his colleagues for dinner. One of them was a papal scholar who told us that in the 18th century, the Catholic Church canonized a dog. Alec asked if that would be St. Bernard. And though it was corny, I can't remember the last time I laughed that hard. October 31st, Cincinnati, Ohio. On CNN, I watched a discussion about post-9/11 America. One of the panelists was the editor of Good Housekeeping, who reflected our new seriousness by placing the stars and stripes atop the traditional gingerbread house gracing the December cover. This is the sort of bullshit CNN is becoming famous for. I looked at this woman thinking, just get the fuck off my TV. All Things Considered featured a report on a Kentucky man who was recently recognized as a hermit by the Catholic Church. The segment made it sound as if being a hermit were an occupation, like being an accountant or an engineer. Tell me, Linda Wertheimer said to the woman connected with the Kentucky Archdiocese, do you have any guidelines for hermits? Do your hermits live in proximity to other hermits? The woman said that many of her hermits held part-time jobs as weavers, which again sounds so ancient. Do you think this is on the rise? Linda Wertheimer asked, being a hermit. Oh, definitely, the woman said, especially now. November 1st, Dearborn, Michigan. I had the night off, so went to the multiplex across the road from the hotel to see Joyride. The only people in the theater were me and an obese woman dressed like a witch. I'd seen her earlier in the lobby, noticed the tall black hat, and thought, that person is going to sit in front of me. And so she did, directly in front of me, though there were hundreds of empty seats for her to choose from. Fucking witch, I whispered. November 2nd. I talked to Amy yesterday. She'd just gotten off the phone with Tiffany, who's having a fight with her boyfriend. He can't stand it when she pees in front of him, so a few days ago, after sitting on the john and groaning, she dropped a bar of soap into the toilet. He thought she was defecating, and what was supposed to be a joke soon escalated into a fight. Tiffany argues that because he never takes her out to dinner, this is the sort of girlfriend he deserves. It's part of her new identity as a poor person, and it illustrates how she's making things up as she goes along. Tiffany's poverty is noble, but I guess this nobility doesn't extend to her boyfriend. Somewhere along the line, she's decided that money has a direct correlation to manners, meaning that a minimum wage girlfriend shits in view of her company, while a salaried woman can afford to close the door. As a poor person, she's decided to identify with Osama bin Laden, whom she sees as a Middle Eastern Robin Hood. She and Paul had a huge fight when he wore a turban and a fake beard to visit a neighbor. She told him he was being disrespectful, and he called her a whore. November 20th, New York. At Provence, on Prince Street, our waiter led us to the kitchen, where we saw the restaurant's prize-winning entry in the recent New York restaurant show. The theme was tragedy, so the chef constructed a replica of the remnants of the World Trade Center, surrounded by a trio of firemen. Made from animal fat and sugar, the sculpture literally embodied the term bad taste. It was nicer last week, the waiter reflected. A few days ago it started to melt and some of the walls have fallen in. November 22nd. The other day the president pardoned a turkey named Liberty. The two of them were pictured on the front page of the Times, the president joyous, the turkey indifferent. Something tells me that she would have been eaten had her name been Chris or Becky. Instead of being served for Thanksgiving, she'll be sent to a petting zoo. Late last night, Hugh and I walked up Central Park West to watch them blowing up the balloons for the Thanksgiving Day parade. In the 1930s, Macy's would cut them free and pay a reward for their return. It sounded like a nice idea, but by the second year, they were being brought back with bullet holes in them, shot down by people desperate for reward money. In the past, you could step up close and watch the inflation, but now they block off the streets, either for security or the fear of lawsuits. We got as close as we could, but it wasn't very satisfying. November 23rd. Dad called last night to say, "You look terrible." He'd seen my Letterman appearance and was angry that I hadn't worn a bow tie. "I told you 100 times, hell, I even gave you the ties, and still you didn't listen to me." My shoes were a disappointment as well. Jesus, what were you doing up there? You had no personality at all. It's Dad's opinion that a bow tie enhances everything you say, elevates it into a language of elegance. With my brown shoes and knit English tie, I looked common, unspecial, boring. God, I just want to shake you. November 25th, Paris. On WNYC, I listened to a report informing us that New York's paranoid schizophrenics were having a difficult time coming to terms with the events of September 11th. It was another example of something we probably could have figured out for ourselves. The reporter interviewed the tenants of a halfway house, people convinced that the hijacked planes had been aiming for them personally. The solution, as with everything else, is counseling, counseling, counseling. December 13th. On Friday, we're supposed to receive our first euros, which will come in little 100-franc packets distributed by the post office and the Bank of France. I say supposed to because both the post office and the Bank of France are threatening to strike starting Friday morning. Apparently this euro business is making them work too hard, and before the program's even started, they've decided they need a raise. Elections are coming up, so this year the strikes are even heavier than before. All of them want to get their licks in before the new administration. December 17th, Budapest, Hungary. The eyewitness travel guide describes Budapest as a glittering jewel, the Paris of the East. On closer inspection, the book is full of errors. It reports, for example, that in winter the city gets only 2.5 hours of sunlight a day and cranks the figure up to 8 for the months of June, July, and August. I'd expected it to get dark at around 10 a.m., but it turned out we had light until 4 in the afternoon. What they probably meant to say was that each evening the city endures 2.5 weeks of darkness. The nights feel impossibly long here, partly because it's cold, but mainly because things are so poorly lit. Everything not pictured in our guidebook fades away once the sun sets. It's as if the country has run out of both paint and light bulbs. When people leave their apartment buildings, most of which are missing great patches of their facades, we peek into the grim, peeling foyers. They burn brown coal in Budapest, and everything is coated with soot. You just want to put the entire city in a bathtub and take to it with a wire brush. I thought our hotel rating was another typo until I realized it had been judged by a different standard. I think in Hungary they give a star for electricity, a star for heat, a star for running water, and so on. The fourth star signifies that the Astoria has cable TV. They boast 40 channels, not mentioning that 23 of them broadcast the exact same programs. Our hotel is fronted in scaffolding, and our rooms offer a view of the mangy, narrow side street. The only thing they excel at here is stoking the furnace. It's below zero outdoors, while inside our rooms we could roast chickens by leaving them on the nightstand. There's a large group of French people at the hotel, and I heard one of the women saying she's so heat-swollen that her rings no longer fit. December 21st, Paris. Gretchen's plane was an hour late and landed at De Gaulle alongside 3 other flights from the United States. It took a while for her to get through passport control, and while waiting, I watched other travelers reunite with their people. Beside me was a family of Americans who'd talk in English and then launch into perfect French, the kids' phrases ending with slangy quas. I got the idea they'd lived here for quite a while and were waiting for family members who'd gone home to the States for college. When the young people appeared, their parents would rush forward, crying most often. The hugging and kissing that ensued was normal, but I think the tears were for September 11th. I'm just so glad you're okay, one woman said. Her son had arrived from Houston. Well, I'm glad you're glad, he said, embarrassed by the attention. Don called last night, and during the course of the conversation, he forgot my name. So Peach said, I don't know that we can give, can give Sedaris both the audio rights and the 10%. I was thinking he could have solved the problem by using the word you, figuring the discussion probably pertained to the person he was calling. When he forgets other people's names, I normally help him out, but it seemed more awkward when the name was my own. "Oh, Lord," he said, "this is going to be a tough day." December 29th. Hugh made me a belated birthday cake, decorated with the candles Patsy gave us for Christmas. When told to make a wish, I settled back in my chair, realizing I should have given it some prior thought. One option was an apartment in London, but in the end I wished for the opposite, the absence of things. Over the past few years, I've fallen deeper into the luxury pit. I used to get pleasure from sitting at the Pancake House with a new library book, but now I mainly buy things and work crossword puzzles. In my 20s and early 30s, I was able to disguise my shallowness, but now it's written all over my shopping bags. On my 45th birthday, I looked across the table at the director Mary Zimmerman and thought, that's what I want, to be like her. I wanted the change to be immediate. Oh, but first there were perfumed soaps to be opened. Gretchen went to the National Museum of Natural History with her friend Patty, and I walked alone to the zoo, the little one at the Jardin des Plantes. I hadn't been in years, and it was a good day for it. In the reptile house, I saw two small children confined to wheelchairs. Both wore glasses and were pushed by their fathers. Crocodiles dozed on the concrete shores of their pen, and I noticed a number of dead cockroaches floating in the water. I saw a lot of unintentional animals yesterday, mainly birds and insects, taking advantage of the free food. The keepers had just fed the vultures, and the floor of their cage was littered with what looked like a medium-sized dog chopped in half with a hatchet. I thought vultures were always hungry, but rather than eat, they stared toward the big cats, where a man in a hat chipped away at a block of marble. You often see people drawing and painting at the zoo, but I'd never seen anyone with a chisel. Sculpting. January 3rd, Paris. I'd always imagined Susan Sontag as delicate, almost brittle, but seated beside her at the dinner table, I noticed that her wrists were easily as thick as her ankles. She was tall and bulky, her trademark skunked hair now dyed a solid black. Stephen had done the seating arrangements, and it was his joke to place me beside her. We talked privately for a minute or two, but most of the conversation was central, with topics ranging from Henry James to a 95-year-old Polish poet I'd never heard of. I was prepared for the worst, but aside from a few displays of obvious boredom, Susan Sontag was, if not warm, then at least well-behaved. She said she couldn't possibly eat cheese off her dinner plate, but that was her only show of fussiness. Outright hostility was reserved for an Englishwoman named Hillary, who looked like Candace Bergen. "I've just been to Libya," she said, "and have noticed that we're really much better off than the rest of the world." Susan Sontag said she'd been noticing this every day of her life, but the jab went unchallenged. "I mean, really," Hillary continued, "there are places where one can't find so much as an aspirin." Susan Sontag said that, yes, we all need aspirin. Seated around the table were Diane Johnson and her husband John, Paolo, Susan Sontag's Italian translator, Stephen, Hugh, James Ivory, and Ishmael Merchant. James and Ishmael are making a movie of Le Divorce, and they start shooting in early March. Ishmael was seated on my right and was just as gracious as he could be. After dessert, he took us up the street and gave us a tour of his grand apartment. He made everyone feel special and interesting, while James Ivory was a bit more businesslike. Diane and her husband are lively and engaging, but for the most part, it was an uncomfortable evening, uncomfortable meaning that I tried my best to keep my mouth shut. January 4th. Don called with a business question, but lost his way while wishing me a happy new year. One moment he was discussing the new book contract, and the next thing I knew, he was in a cab with Ray Bradbury and Zero Mostel. He had an apartment on 72nd and wanted to show me this cloth he'd put things on, painted things on, these paintings he'd done. January 7th. It snowed 12 inches in Raleigh, and my brother's street was blocked off. He lives at the bottom of a hill, and people came from all over with their seldom-used sleds and toboggans. Dad dropped by late in the morning and warned Paul against overdoing it, saying, "You're fat now, and you've got to be careful. You might hurt yourself." He said it the way one might warn a senior, "You're old now," as if Paul's condition were irreversible. To prove him wrong, Paul tried a complicated trick and dislocated his shoulder. Unable to sled, he now sits in the house, eating cookies and growing fatter. Every day feels the same, in part because every day looks the same. Again, yesterday it was cold and cloudy, the sky the flat gray color of a nickel. We'd planned to go to Normandy, but it turns out the agency in Argentan has no more rental cars. Going without one means that Hugh will spend the entire week in a sour mood, threatening every 15 minutes to sell the house and move back to New York. We'd both look forward to getting away, but I'm definitely handling the disappointment better than he is. I just watched as he poured an entire bag of coffee into the stovetop espresso machine. Grounds spilled onto the counter, and when I asked what he was doing, he brushed them onto the floor, saying, flatly, "Making coffee." January 23rd. Monday night was our co-op meeting, which was held in the coiffure shop on the ground floor of our building. Hugh had attended one last spring, but this was my first. The apartment owners, seven of us altogether, gathered up chairs and sat in a semicircle facing an architect and our efficient syndic, a thin woman in her early 50s whose job it is to manage things and who tended to interrupt whoever was speaking with "c'est normal, c'est normal." What wasn't normal got her full attention for a period averaging between 30 and 45 seconds. The main point of business was to vote on the roof repair. Two estimates had been given, and the architect suggested we accept the higher bid, claiming the lower would wind up costing us more in the long run. Madame S. presented a case for fixing her retaining wall, saying it had been moistened and damaged by the leaking roof. "I said as much to my husband," she said. I'm not sure exactly how long her husband's been dead, but Madame S. mentioned him at least a dozen times, most often in the context of some prediction. "I told him. He told me." In the middle of the meeting, she pulled out a test tube containing a tiny lump of calcium. She'd harvested it from her drain and waved it in the air, hoping to make a point. "C'est normal, madame," the syndic said. "C'est normal." Though everyone was civil, I sensed that our neighbors had long ago grown tired of Madame S. Smiles faded as soon as she opened her mouth. The syndic examined her notes. The architect doodled in the margins of his floor plan. At one point she complained that the third floor tenants of number 98 Boulevard Saint-Germain had held a party, and the noise, the music, "c'est normal," the syndic said. Of all the partners, my favorites were a couple who owned the tiny apartment on the half-landing between the first and second floors. They've got a leak in the roof, but their biggest problem is their tenant, who hasn't paid rent in months. "Oh, him," everyone said. "He's crazy." The husband was honey-colored and spoke with an accent I couldn't identify. He was maybe in his late 60s, but his face was unlined and surprised-looking. "Well, we know he's crazy," he said. "I just wish we'd known it sooner." The meeting proceeded, and just as it was winding up, the syndic laid down her papers. "Who's been building fires?" she asked. The informer, of course, had been Madame S., who conveniently re-examined her test tube of calcium. According to the syndic, fires are essentially illegal in Paris. People build them all the time, but apparently not her people. If it simply came down to asphyxiating Madame S., she'd be all for it. But legally, any death would be the Sandique's responsibility. Our options are to entube the chimney, which would allow us to build charcoal fires, or tear down the building and reconstruct it from scratch. I left the meeting, my face burning. I'd chosen this apartment specifically because of the fireplaces, and if we can't use them, I'd just as soon move. At the Odeon metro stop, I saw a baby lying alone in her basket next to an ashtray and a little sign reading, "Aidez-moi, s'il vous plaît." The mother was hanging out at the top of the stairs and would look down every few minutes, checking to see if she'd earned any money. January 26th, Florence, Italy. Me. What do you want as your main birthday gift, Hugh? I want to attend Madame S.'s funeral. January 28th. Florence often smells like toast. January 30th. Paris. It took over 12 hours to get from our Florence hotel room to our apartment in Paris. Hugh and I awoke at 4:30 a.m. and walked through our door, finally, at 10 to 5 in the afternoon. The first problem was the fog. We'd boarded our plane at 7:15 and spent an hour and a half parked on the runway, listening as the guy behind us crabbed at his wife. Actually, crabbed is too gentle a word. He screamed at her. "For God's sake, will you just shut up?" He was an American in his 70s, tall and bearded, who topped his greasy hair with a black beret. "I'm sick of hearing about it, so just shut up. Can you do that? Shut up." Boarding the plane had put him in a foul mood, and his mood worsened when they sent out a bus and returned us to the airport. Like most of our fellow passengers, the American couple had a connecting flight in Paris. At 10 a.m., they still had a chance of making it, but by noon, all hope was gone. While Hugh and I talked with a Canadian schoolteacher, the bearded man roamed the waiting room, loudly complaining to whoever would listen. His wife sat alone, huddled in her mink, and after a while I stopped feeling sorry for her. You don't just suddenly become an award-winning asshole. It takes years of practice, years she doubtlessly spent mortified in other, larger waiting rooms with payphones and magazine racks. They had us reboard at around 1, and again her husband started yelling. He screamed when a man with glasses accidentally took the window seat. "You'd think he'd never been on a goddamn plane." He screamed when his wife tried wedging her purse beneath the seat, and he screamed when a fat man arranged his coat in the overhead compartment. "Hey," he said, "you want to back off?" "Excuse me? You're invading our space, goddammit." "I was just trying to..." "Bullshit! You're knocking against my wife. Back off!" The fat man was also from the United States. Clean-shaven, with gold-rimmed glasses. "You, sir," he said, "are being an ugly American." "Piss off," the bearded man said. "An ugly, ugly American." The fat man laid his self-help book on his seat and called for the flight attendant. "Excuse me, miss," he said, "but you might want to keep an eye on this gentleman." "Oh, kiss my ass," the bearded man spat. He was quiet for a few minutes, but started up again when the pilot announced a baggage identification check. A few of our fellow passengers had gone missing, and we couldn't proceed until their luggage had been removed from the plane. This involved unloading the cargo hold and spreading its contents on the runway. In groups of 20, we were instructed to disembark, identify our suitcases, and reboard. The process took over an hour, and we didn't take off until 2:15, by which point the whole thing had become a terrible comedy. The bearded man brightened with his third glass of champagne and fell asleep shortly afterward. Her crossword puzzle finished, his wife put her head on his shoulder and quietly, so as not to wake him, chewed the end of her pencil. February 8th. Yosef called yesterday afternoon, asking if I'd found the time to read his screenplay. I told him I hadn't, and he said, "Well, I read your book, and hated it." He translated my laugh as, "Tell me more, please," and went on to offer a detailed critique of Barrel Fever. It didn't bother me, as the book is almost 10 years old, and I hate it now, too. On top of that, it's sort of exciting to know someone who's that direct. I listened to him, certain that, should I hate his screenplay, I'd never admit it. The directness will always be one-sided. February 9th. I met Yosef at the Viaduct des Arts, and we took the train to his riding stables in the Bois de Boulogne. Before leaving, I'd resolved to be more interesting, but by the time we reached the metro station, I felt that I'd failed, and it was too late to make up for it. He's a very nice guy, but I couldn't seem to remember what friends talk about. "What did you have for dinner last night?" I asked. "Did your dog sleep well?" He asked me a few questions in French, and then resorted to English, saying, "I forgot. It's easier for you." I wanted to say that French was fine, but felt it would be burdening him even further. "What will you eat tonight?" I asked. "Will your dog stay up late?" The stables were large and broken up into different areas. In one building, a teacher instructed a group of young women in how to apply a horseshoe. He kept telling his pupils, "décontracté," which means relax. Yosef said it's the most used word in any sports-related conversation. He said that the French invented both laziness and the belief that rules were meant to be broken, and I wondered if he was saying that because he's Swiss. We walked around in the mud and rain, and then visited the stable cafe for a cup of coffee. It was a large, sad place, nearly deserted. Through a glass wall, we could see teenage girls on horseback, trotting around in a circle. While we sat there, Yosef told me of the time he visited Munich and stole a bicycle. It's a second episode of petty theft he's admitted to, and again, he made it sound very reasonable. All around me, people were riding bikes and enjoying themselves, so I thought, why not me? He said he'd planned to return it when he was finished, but the police stopped him before he could even leave the park. It was, he said, a real fiasco. On the train back, Yosef asked what kind of animal I might be if I were suddenly transformed into a cartoon character. I didn't quite understand the question, so he offered an example, saying that he himself would be a bear. "Sometimes I am cuddly, like a panda," he said. "But if I get in a bad mood, watch out." I tried to imagine him as a cartoon bear, dressed in a raincoat and yellow sneakers, and decided that, with his red hair and penchant for stealing, he'd probably make a much better fox. "So come on," he said. "What are you?" I'd never given it much thought, but figured I'd probably be an ant. When Hugh and I moved into the new apartment, I carried everything but the furniture, making 6 or 7 trips a day from the old place to the new one. When I pictured all our belongings, it seemed futile, so I never thought beyond the load I was transporting at the time. Books, shoes, pots and pans, the television. I was like an ant deconstructing a scrap of bread. Yosef seemed dissatisfied with my answer and announced that I'd most likely be an oyster. "Because sometimes you look at me and I have no idea what you're thinking." "How can you tell if an oyster is looking at you in the first place?" I asked. "They don't even have eyes, do they?" "Well," Yosef said, "you know what I mean." It seemed vaguely insulting to be compared to an oyster. I wanted to replead my case for the ant, but instead I just let it go. He invited me to his house for a piece of pie, but I begged off. "I'm super busy right now," I said. Then I came back to my apartment and took a bath, counting the hours until Hugh came home. Over coffee, Yosef taught me the word beauf, which is short for beau-frère. It means brother-in-law, but the shortened version connotes an element of tedium. A beauf branché is a brother-in-law who mistakenly considers himself to be hip. February 12th. Sunday at 3 a.m., an American couple had a fight on the street in front of our building. I'm guessing they were in their late 20s, both drunk. Apparently the girl had had her jacket stolen at the bar. Her: "Well, I told you to watch it." Him: "That isn't the point." "Then forget about it. I'll just get a new fucking passport." "Well, I'm not going to forget about it. I'm not. You're just mad because you gave it to me." "Hey, that is not the point. Yes, I gave it to you. It was expensive. It looked damn good on you, but that is not the point. Oh, please." The point is that you just stood there and let them laugh at you. They weren't laughing. They were. You said that stupid stuff and let them laugh because..." He grabbed her by the shoulders and slammed her against the wall, a separate slam for every word. "You don't have any self-respect." She recovered herself, and then, as if it were a scene memorized from a play, they started again from the top. Her: "Well, I told you to watch it." March 2nd. In return for our help getting her hot water heater installed, Peggy took us to dinner at the Hotel Bristol, where I learned about foams. According to her, it's the new trend. Stocks are reduced to a potent broth and then whipped up to resemble scum. I had a foie gras soup that looked as if it had been pissed on. Hugh had sea urchins, the shells emptied out and filled with what looked to be dirty bubble bath. The problem with foam, aside from its general ugliness, is its texture. Unlike, say, a mousse, it doesn't really take to the mouth. The flavor was there, but I missed the heft of a heavy fork. I missed chewing. Also, I realized that should the trend continue, you'd never again be able to tell if the waiter had spit in your food. At the Café Marly, some things are foamed and others are not. Hugh ordered the pig head and received a perfectly recognizable nose and ear surrounded by vegetables. March 5th. I went to see The Honey Pot, a 1967 movie starring Rex Harrison and a very young Maggie Smith. Even in her 20s, her face unlined, she had the eyes of a man. They're heavily lashed, but somehow seemed to contain masculine information. Maggie Smith's eyes know about shaving. March 9th, La Bagotière. Little Brown forwarded an envelope of mail, and I realized after reading it over that every single letter wanted something from me. The senders included a college student writing an article on magazine readership. I'm on a deadline, so email me as soon as you get this. A Cleveland man who's written a gay travel guide and wants my help finding an agent. An Indianapolis human rights group wanting me to attend their rally. Your agent says you haven't got the time, but I suspect you do. A Seattle drama group asking for an essay on how theater has changed my life. Three Nashville high school students assigned to read a bestseller and write the author with questions such as, "Have you written any other books? Where do you get your ideas?" A German woman writing her PhD on the role of the diary in contemporary American fiction. She, too, is on a deadline and asks that I call her Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, trying several times per night until I reach her. A gay choral group asking for mementos they might auction off at their upcoming fundraiser, Life is a Cabaret. March 13th, Paris. Hugh and Manuela are wood-graining the study of a well-known actor. Yesterday they asked him what color carpet he'd chosen, and he answered, "Tête de nègre." This translates to "nigger's head," and he repeated it several times. There was a black man installing baseboards in the next room, and when Hugh suggested that maybe he keep it down, the actor said, "It's not racist, it's a color. Ask anyone." March 21st. Again, I reported to the Polyarthritis Center in the 19th. I'd signed up for volunteer work, hoping it might improve my French, but yesterday afternoon I said nothing more complicated than hello and goodbye. The promised new shelves still hadn't arrived. Papers couldn't be sorted, so instead of filing, I cleaned and carried out trash. I mopped the floor and washed the windows, and after a while, I started feeling like a foreign maid, the type people smile at as they say, "Let me get out of your way." I didn't necessarily mind. It just wasn't what I'd expected. March 30th, New York. On Wednesday, Milton Berle, Billy Wilder, and Dudley Moore died. The papers have been running nice long obituaries, the fondest for Billy Wilder. I read his notice in yesterday's Times while on the way to Amy's. I read Milton Berle's in the Tribune while waiting in the Delta check-in line. On yesterday's flight, I was surprised by the number of families flying first class, parents with children. The couple in front of me had two adolescents who complained about the wait. "This is like the line for coach or something," the girl said, "just like in Barcelona." April 6th, Raleigh. At the Austin airport, the magazines Swank, Busty, Stud, Playboy, and High Society are grouped under the heading Sophisticates. The New Yorker, on the other hand, is placed under General Interest. A few hours later, at the Dallas airport, I saw a sign reading, "Patriotic T-shirts, 50% off." That pretty much represents the national mood. Tax time is here, and people are realizing that pride costs money. I was on the second leg of my trip to Raleigh, standing in the bathroom, when I noticed how old I looked. The lights were fairly harsh, and I studied myself as I simultaneously peed all over the floor. It looked to be a good 16 ounces, and when the plane pitched, a small lake flowed toward the door. It was panic time, and after trying to mop it up with toilet tissue, I switched to paper towels. They couldn't be flushed, so I had to throw them in the trash bin, which was already full. So there I was, a pee-soaked paper towel in each hand, looking really, really old. April 18th, Houston, Texas. The Lancaster is described as an older luxury hotel located in the heart of the thriving theater district. I arrived yesterday afternoon and was greeted by a bellman who reached for my suitcase. "Oh, I've got it," I said. "Really, it's no problem at all." He was a black man in his 60s with gray hair and a bushy beard. "Are you sure?" he asked. "There's no obligation." At the desk, I checked in. The manager and concierge introduced themselves, then handed the key to the bellman, who said he needed to take me to the room. "I have to show you a few things," he said. "Otherwise, you might not be able to figure them out." He pointed out the first floor restaurant, which was marked by a large sign reading "Restaurant." "There's a restaurant," he said, "and one floor up, we've got what we call the mezzanine." By this time, he'd wrangled away my suitcase, which he rolled into the elevator. "You're on 9," he said, "so we'll just push this button right here." I imagined that my room was protected by some incredibly technical security system, but it was just the standard lock and key. The bellman opened the door and pointed to the armoire. "Now your TV's in there," he said, "and it operates by remote. You got an alarm clock, a fax machine, and a bathroom." Had I lived my entire life in a dark forest, his little speech might have been helpful. "My bathroom? For me? To use? What's a TV?" As it was, his little tour amounted to a shakedown. You can't not tip a bellman, so I gave him $5, feeling all the while that I'd been taken advantage of. April 19th, Los Angeles. While packing to leave Houston, I felt a mounting anxiety about the bellman, whom I'd grown to hate. He'd be waiting downstairs, and while finishing my exercises, I imagined the many things I'd say when he inevitably tried to wrestle away my bag. "Sir, no." I said, "No." If he took it anyway, I'd simply leave him without a tip and say, "Look, I told you not to help." 15 minutes before checkout, I carried the typewriter down to the lobby. They'd gotten me a Selectric rather than a Wheelwriter, and it weighed a ton. "Oh, you didn't have to do that," the man at the front desk said. "We would have sent Larry to fetch it." The bellman, who I guessed was named Larry, swooped in to scold me. "Now that's not right," he said. "Mr. Sedaris, whenever you're ready, I'll go get that suitcase. Goodness, carrying that heavy typewriter all by yourself." I said I wouldn't be needing any help, and he skulked off to bide his time. A car was coming at 11, and as I waited out front, he moved in to brag about his city. "Houston's a beautiful place, but best of all is our people," he said. "Friendliest folks on earth." He said he'd once gone to New York and tried to engage a stranger in conversation. The guy said, "Look, I don't know you and I don't want to know you, so just buzz off." Larry shook his head. "That ain't no way to be, 'cause see, I'm from Texas. I like to see a smile." The car pulled up, and he pried my suitcase out of my hands. "Really," I insisted, "I can do it myself." The driver opened the door to the back seat, and Larry ran around and opened the opposite one, saying, "This is a side a person should get in on." I wish I could say I'd given him nothing, but of course I caved in, hating him all the while. April 20th, Escondido, California.